From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, what should medicine do when it can't save your life? We talk with Dr. Atul Gawande about how some end-of-life treatments result in making patients' remaining days worse without extending their lives. Gawande's article, Letting Go, which is published in the current edition of The New Yorker, also describes what it means when a patient opts for hospice care. Also, we hear from Steve Carell, who stars in the new film comedy Dinner for Schmucks, and Jay Roach, who directed it. And our rock historian, Ed Ward, brings us the story of Sugar Pie DeSanto, one of the most unusual rhythm and blues singers from the 1960s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of us know someone who was treated for incurable cancer with chemotherapy, hoping the treatment would extend the amount of time they had left. But they suffered terrible symptoms from the chemo, and when the chemo didn't seem to be effective, elected to try even more aggressive treatments, treatments that only seemed to cause more suffering before they died. Dr. Atul Gawande writes about such a story in the current edition of The New Yorker. The larger question he raises is, what should medicine do when it can't save your life? He considers difficult decisions doctors and patients have to make about end-of-life care, including when to stop therapy, when to say no to more chemo or to a ventilator because it will only cause more suffering without extending life in a meaningful way. He also writes about what it means when you opt for hospice care. Gawande is a surgeon who also writes about medicine for The New Yorker, where he's a staff writer. Atul Gawande, welcome back to Fresh Air. You know, you write about how so much of the choice about whether to continue with therapy and to go to experimental therapy and how harsh a therapy to enlist for is often left to the patient and their family to decide. But we patients aren't doctors and we don't have all the research at our fingertips, and it's hard to know. And as you point out, patients often wait for the doctor to say, there's nothing more I can do for you. And at that point, you stop treatment. But as you point out, there's usually not a point where a doctor says, there's nothing more we can do for you, because there's always something that can be done. What do you mean by that?
Well, it is this interesting evolution. We were this completely paternal profession. We didn't even tell you when you had an incurable condition. You know, we thought that that would just be more than people can handle. We have moved away from the paternalistic mode of, here is what we're going to do, and you don't need to worry your pretty little head about that, to a world that's almost the diametric opposite. We are willing to throw all of the options out there and just say, you tell us what you want to do. And the options that are there, you know, right up to the end include, you know, if you start having trouble breathing, do we want to put you on the ventilator? Do we want to put you in the intensive care unit? Your kidneys, when they shut down, you know, shall we put you on dialysis? Should we shock your heart when it stops? A feeding tube when you stop being able to eat? A tracheostomy to keep you on a ventilator as time goes on? The moment of crisis always comes. And we want medicine to help with many of those steps. We don't want to abandon things that might get us more of the life we want. But medicine's focus, what we do as doctors, is we sacrifice time now for the possibility of prolonged life. But we all have more wider values, things we care about besides that. We want to be with others and family. We'd like to be mentally alert as much as possible. We'd like to avoid suffering, and we'd like to spend our last time doing stuff we care about and not just, you know, taking in treatments that make us suffer.
Well, what you're talking about is kind of antithetical to a lot of the treatments that we get when we're dying, because those treatments are so debilitating. You're not going to be yourself. You're barely going to be cognizant sometimes by the time you're done with all the treatments. The likelihood of the real meaningful moments at the end with family are often diminished because the person who is dying can't speak or think clearly anymore. Is that your experience? Yeah. I mean, I've seen that.
Yeah, you know, I walked through our intensive care unit. I had a patient in our medical intensive care unit who I had to see for a surgical consultation, and I ran into someone I'd gone to college and medical school with who happened to be the critical care physician on duty that day. And she just had it. She felt like, she said, you know, I'm running a warehouse for the dying here. Because 8 out of the 10 people in her unit that week, in fact, for that month, were people with terminal disease, whether it was end-stage heart failure, end-stage liver failure, end-stage cancer. And in the big picture, she didn't feel like there was really anything she was doing to help improve their lives, and in many ways felt like she was causing more suffering. So these were people who were on the ventilator, on dialysis, you know, tracheostomy and feeding tube, in this kind of warehoused oblivion, toggling between being conscious and not being conscious, and even when they're conscious, they're not really clear about what's going on, where, and how. And what's sort of terrifying about it is that these were people who came into the hospital thinking that, well, maybe we'd be able to get through this, and yes, I think I could get home this time. And then the care escalated to the point that they never got to say goodbye or I love you or I'm sorry. And, you know, they've got their husband or wife or other family sitting with them, and they will pass on from this world without ever having realized that, you know what, this was the moment. This was it. And is this the way you'd really want it to have happened?
How would you as a doctor identify what a patient wants at the end of their life?
You know, it's interesting. When I started writing this article, I did it because I didn't know how to do that. I didn't really understand. And what struck me was a study I read. It's called the Coping with Cancer Project. And the Coping with Cancer Project looked at hundreds of patients getting care for end-stage cancer. And the striking thing was 2/3 of them had not had any discussion about what they wanted at the end, despite the fact that they were on average, they proved to be 4 months from death. The 1/3 that had a discussion with their doctors about their goals for the end were less likely to be in an ICU, less likely to die on a ventilator or be shocked, more likely to take hospice. And the fascinating thing is they suffered less, they were more capable and more alert for longer in their lives. And then 6 months after they died, their family members were less likely to be suffering from major depression. I was often in that 2/3 that was steering away from that discussion rather than having it. And I needed to know how to do that.
What is that discussion that you're referring to?
I met with a woman named Susan Block, who's kind of an expert in these discussions. She's a palliative care specialist at the Dana-Farber. And she described a list of things that she has in her head that she tries to go through in the course of the discussions with patients. And one of the things she pointed out to me is that this discussion is often one you cannot have just in one moment in time. It's a sequence of things. And her list was not, do you want this chemotherapy or not, or do you want this operation or not? It was, how do you want to spend time as options in your life become limited? How do you want to spend your time? What trade-offs are you willing to make? What concerns do you really have about what lies ahead here? Do you actually know what your prognosis is? You know that you're dealing with an incurable disease, but do you know what the timeline often is? And who do you want to have make decisions when you reach the point that you can't? That series of conversations is incredibly hard. And what makes it even harder is the patient is not the only one who needs to have that conversation. The whole family needs to, because she told me about some research that showed that when patients even know the answers to these questions, and they often haven't really reached that point, 2/3 of the time they're willing to take treatments they don't actually want if they think that the family wants them to go ahead with it. And so you need to get everybody kind of on board. And that's, you know, that's not often the way we think about it, but when it happens, it goes better.
This palliative care specialist who you talked to about end-of-life conversations, she had one of those conversations with her own father when he was dying, and she asked him what level of being alive is tolerable for him. And he said as long as he could eat chocolate ice cream and watch football on TV, it was still worth being alive. And that helped guide her when she had to make difficult decisions on his behalf about his medical care. So are you conducting these kinds of conversations now with your patients?
You know, as a consequence of writing through the article, I'm starting to think about how to walk through it this way. And the unexpected thing to me was that it's not just with my patients, it's with my own family. Jack Block, her father, 74-year-old professor father, had a spinal cord tumor and had to undergo an operation that had a 20% chance of leaving him quadriplegic. And by some, well, you know, it's not entirely happenstance that that's a story I told, because my 75-year-old surgeon father has the same story. And that story that she described really just rung with me. In the course of writing the article, my father's been with this incurable spinal cord tumor for the last 3 years. A year ago, it progressed to the point of paralyzing his left hand, and he had to stop his surgery practice. And then a month ago, it reached a point that he started stumbling, and then one day called me that he wasn't able to stand up from sitting. He got some steroids that reduced the swelling of the tumor in the short term enough that those capabilities came back. And he was planned for the same operation that Jack Block, Susan Block's father, went through. And so we had a series of conversations, and I remember one of these extremely vividly in my living room, where we went through this conversation. In a way, it was, brought us closer than we'd ever been. And it was a conversation before any crisis could come. But he was going to undergo this operation to try to relieve the pressure and keep him from progressing to quadriplegia. And I asked him what trade-offs he was willing to make. I asked him almost the same question: what are you willing to go through to be alive here? And I told him about Jack Block's answer. If I can eat chocolate ice cream and watch football on TV, that would be good enough for me. He said, that's not good enough for me. He said, I'm social. I need to be with people. And he's a surgeon. I think he needs to feel a little more control. That being on a feeding tube, no question, that's not in there. But even if I can eat and watch television, but if I'm quadriplegic and I can't interact and get out in the world and do those things, and I have this incurable tumor anyway that will, with time, get me, he said, don't wake me up if after the surgery I'm quadriplegic. Don't do the ventilator. Don't do the tracheostomy. Don't do the feeding tube. And I understood it. The thinking through that the writing made me go through and talking to these palliative care specialists and understanding what great care could look like, it has affected how I treat my patients, but it's also affecting how I handle things with my dad. Now, the good news, he got through the operation, a 9-hour operation to create more space in his spinal cord for the tumor to grow, and unbelievably, he just did fabulously. He was eating cornflakes on the third day after surgery, sitting up in bed. He was home 8 days after the operation, and we're all thinking about, okay, we've got ourselves another year or two. What's on our list? What do we want to do?
My guest is surgeon and medical writer Atul Gawande. His article, Letting Go, What Should Medicine Do When It Can't Save Your Life, is published in the current edition of The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Atul Gawande, who writes about medical issues for The New Yorker. His latest article is called Letting Go, What Should Medicine Do When It Can't Save Your Life? So many people at the end now choose hospice. And when you choose hospice, it often means giving up on other medical care that you could get. What types of care do you have to decline from that point on?
You tend to decline things like calling 911 and going to an emergency room if something goes wrong. You are not going in to see the oncologist about the chemotherapy or going in to see the surgeon about whether you'll try to take out part of the tumor. You are still seeing doctors and nurses about whether there are things that can be done to make your life better. And that was a surprise to me. I went on walking around on visits with a hospice nurse because my mental image of hospice was just, it's a morphine drip. It was not what I found, which was a nurse who was helping people address
well, how's your breathing and what can we do to make your breathing as good as it can be given the circumstances? Or what do we do to make sure we have you on your heart medications to try to prevent a heart attack? All of those more complicated steps of asking, you know, how do we get you out for the weekend when you want to get out for the weekend? That is part of what they do.
So there is an experiment going on now that you read about that I thought was really interesting. It's called the Concurrent Care Experimental Program. Would you describe that?
Yeah. Aetna started it, the insurance company, and they recognized what we recognize everywhere, that people with terminal disease, at the end, only a minority choose hospice. And if they choose hospice, it's just in the last few days at the most. And so what they did is they said, well, let's offer hospice to people without making them sign the form that says, I'm giving up my chemotherapy, the option to go to the emergency room or the surgeon or the radiation and so on. But they still sent the hospice nurse to visit at home and ask all the questions about, you know, how can we make your life better now? And so no surprise, enrollment in hospice went from 28% for those families to 70%. But the real surprise was that once they had both available to them, they went to the hospital less. They were less likely to die in the ICU. They spent 25% less money at the end of life, and the families were happier. And what it seemed to be was that the either-or divide, in order to get good care for what your goals are other than prolonging life, you have to give up on the idea of prolonging life. You know, that it blew up that idea. It said you could try what they called concurrent care. Could use a sexier name than that. But and that has been now studied enough to see that this has been replicated.
Now, the kind of end-of-life conversation that you were talking about earlier that you think doctors should have with patients, in which the patients and their families can clarify what they want the end of their life to be like and what physical compromises they're willing to go through in order to have treatment and what they don't want to go through. Are those kinds of conversations the things that were described as death panels during the debate about health insurance?
Yeah. it got mutated into that. The health reform bill had funding to have those kinds of discussions. These discussions at the end of life are long. They're multiple, and sometimes they're not with the patient themselves, but with the family members. I describe one oncologist discussing the care for a 29-year-old with a brain tumor that was at end stage. And he'd been through two rounds of chemotherapy and radiation, and he was ready to stop, but his family wasn't. And the oncologist had separate visits for the father, actually visited the father at home and talked through, you know, every possible option and what ultimately needed to be done, which was that the family needed to be there for their son. And that's not covered by insurance. She said to me, I can't tell you how much easier it would have been to just sign him up for another round of chemotherapy. And by the way, she would have been paid better. The health reform bill had a provision to allow for these doctors to have these conversations and fund them for them to happen. And it was stripped out because of the argument that this amounted to a death panel.
And were you angry about that?
You know, at the time, I just thought it was kind of ridiculous. I knew it was an exaggeration, but this is politics, and some of that is bound to happen. What I didn't appreciate until I really tried to delve into writing about, you know, what do we do? What's the most beneficial thing we can do to make end-of-life care better and cope with the costliness of it? That's where I realized, wow, this was the pivot of it. This is where it can happen. Now, funding for those discussions isn't the only thing that needs to happen. The ability to even change medical training, to walk doctors and also, you know, non-doctors, even non-clinicians through how to have these conversations well, is going to be a crucial part of being able to transform a system of care to not just be about the time we have. The most fascinating thing about it, though, is that we see this as all about trade-offs. You know, are we going to give up $80,000 drugs that would get us 2 months of life? The reality is that at the end, the way we care for people probably worsens their life and shortens their life. A study of 5,000 Medicare patients that matched people who chose hospice against people who didn't choose hospice found that those who chose hospice didn't die any sooner than the people who chose to stick with going to the hospital and so on. And furthermore, for conditions like lung cancer and heart failure, those patients actually live longer in the end by weeks. In the case of heart failure, 3 months longer. And that reveals to us that we have some dysfunctional decision-making towards the end, where that fourth round of chemotherapy is certainly not buying them time and is probably stealing not just quality of life, but stealing time from people.
Atul Gawande, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Atul Gawande's article, Letting Go, What Should Medicine Do When It Can't Save Your Life, is published in the current edition of The New Yorker. You'll find a link to the article on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Booz Allen Hamilton, strategy and technology consultants at boozallen.com/ready for what's next. From Plowshares Fund, dedicated to helping build a safe, secure, and nuclear weapon-free world at plowshares.org. And from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, how to play a schmuck and how to direct one. We talk with Steve Carell, the star of the new film comedy, Dinner for Schmucks, and Jay Roach, the director. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles a rhythm and blues singer who was fond of doing backflips on stage, Sugar Pie DeSanto. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It may not be the most admirable thing to gossip about what jerks we encountered at some dinner party, but we do it, and that guilty pleasure is at the heart of the new comedy Dinner for Schmucks that's opening in theaters this weekend. Our guests are Steve Carell, who stars in the film, and Jay Roach, who directed it. Carell is a veteran of The Daily Show and starred in The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Little Miss Sunshine. Carell recently announced that next season will be his final season on the NBC comedy series The Office. Jay Roach directed the 3 Austin Powers films, as well as Meet the Parents, Meet the Fockers, and the HBO movie Recount. In Dinner for Schmucks, Paul Rudd plays an ambitious young financial analyst whose mean-spirited boss hosts an annual event he calls the Dinner for Winners. It's actually a competition in which he makes his subordinates bring the biggest idiots they can find. They all make fun of the guests, and the boss decides who's the biggest jerk. Carell plays Barry Speck, the idiot that Rudd's character brings. Steve Carell and Jay Roach spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Jay Roach, Steve Carell, welcome to Fresh Air. Steve Carell, talk a little bit about this character.
Barry Speck, I see him as a guy who lives on the fringe of society. He's an incredibly optimistic person, wears his heart on his sleeve, and just wants to make everyone else around him happy. And in doing so, it has the exact opposite effect. He tends to spread misery wherever he goes. But it's so well-intentioned and so well-meaning, and he has such a big heart. And that's really what drew me to the character. I found him to be a very kind character, but someone who inflicts damage.
Yeah. a true gift for saying and doing the wrong thing. Let's listen to a clip from the film. This is Steve Carell's character, Barry Speck, who's sitting down for lunch at an important meeting for a client of his friend. And well, you'll get the idea. Let's listen.
Where are you from?
We are from Switzerland.
Barry, you know what? We're going to focus on business right now.
Switzerland! I love Switzerland. It is one of my favorite countries. I love your army knives with the toothpicks and your cheese. Does the cheese come out of the cow with the holes? Our countries are not enemies. They are friends. We are friends.
You have been to Switzerland?
No, but I have a friend who drives a Volvo.
And that is Steve Carell from the film Dinner with Schmucks. He is our guest, along with the film's director, Jay Roach. Steve, so this guy, he talks a little too loud and a little too distinctly.
A little too much.
Yeah, a little too much.
Well, when you see that scene play out, David Walliams plays this Swiss industrialist with piercing blue eyes. I think he decided to wear these ultra light blue contacts and dye his hair a blonde. So it's this image that Barry is going up against is so steely and so cool and so intimidating. I think that adds to the whole idea of the scene.
And he goes utterly unfazed.
All Barry is trying to do in that scene is help his friend Tim. And everything comes from such a generous place with him. And it's very sweet. And SJ said as well, it also, I think underpinning all of it is a sense of sadness, you know, a true sense of loss in his life. He's somebody, and when Jay and I first started talking about the character, I said, I feel he's the type of guy who always needs to keep moving, either physically or mentally, because if he stops, if he reflects for too long, he'll spin into a terrible depression because his life is sort of pitiful. You know, it's certainly in the minds of others.
Now, I know that there was a lot of script revision and a lot of improvisation in the film. Do you guys remember whether the scene we just heard was kind of as originally written or riffed?
The predicament of the scene was scripted pretty carefully, actually, but that thing you just heard was almost entirely made up by Steve on the spot, and as were a number of other things. We had a great script by Dave Guillon and Mike Handelman, but once you have such a great predicament scripted and a lot of great lines, obviously, then what happens when you work with brilliant improvisers, they find other things, particularly when their character, they're so just completely connected to the characters the way Steve is, and yet they're playing with dialogue and playing with different lines, but it's always, you know, dialed in to the character and to the suspense of what's going on in the scene. So that was a really good example of the mixture of script and brilliant improvisation.
Right.
I don't think improvising will solve a problem in a script. I think it it can embellish. You can find different jokes or different options. But if the script isn't solid, if the narrative isn't good, you have nothing to go on as an improviser. And that's kind of the way I try to go about it, is that I just, you know, I try to place, obviously, myself where the character is and say things and do things that the character might do in that moment, and or just react to things that other people are improvising. That's always, to me, that's always the greatest gift to get, is, you know, when somebody else throws a curveball in and you have to react to it, and it can change up the scene. It can, even if the lines are exactly the same, it can give the scene a different kind of essence. And so that's I think the fun of it.
One of the things that's really funny about improvisation is that it's when the audience knows that you're improvising. Because then you come up with a line and they think not only, hey, that's a clever line, but, man, he just came up with that line off the top of his head. In
you
a
know
film
what the
like
best
that,
thing is?
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. I think the best thing is really when you have a scripted line that people think was improvised. That to me is the best. And there are moments in this movie that people think are improvised, but they're scripted only because they were so well played. So that to me is really the most wonderful moment, is when it's seamless between the two.
Right. Yeah, I was going to disagree too, because I love it when the audience, I like that they are trying to sort of in the back of their mind wonder whether some of it's being made up. But I actually love it when Steve does it so often, it's you can't tell the difference. And I think like there's a difference in like Saturday Night Live, or when you're watching certain kind of skit comedy live, when you really love that sense of the high wire act, like, oh, they're making it up and they're gonna have to keep the ball in the air. And but when the best improvisers, I think you enjoy not knowing, and you sort of sense it's going on in the background.
Our guests are Jay Roach and Steve Carell. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guests are actor Steve Carell and Jay Roach. They both collaborated on the new film Dinner for Schmucks. Jay Roach, you've had a great career doing comedies. You did Meet the Fockers and Meet the Family and the Austin Powers films. But I really loved the HBO film Recount, which you directed, which is the dramatic recreation of the Florida recount following the 2000 election. You want to talk a little bit about making this stuff work on film? It's a complicated political and legal tale, and you got to give it drama and suspense.
You do, but the story had so much built-in drama and suspense. It was an incredible script by Danny Strong, and he just found a way, you know, to keep you on the edge of your seat. It was really, I credit that script more than a lot of what I did, and then the only thing I would say that I tried to add to it was a little bit of humor. It was such an absurd situation in so many ways, with some fairly absurd characters, and I find when you, I like films where they cast people who can be funny and can find irony in the situation to play very dramatic parts. So casting people like Kevin Spacey and Laura Dern and Dennis Leary to me was kind of the secret to having people pay a little closer attention, because they knew it wouldn't be too serious.
Yeah, there's a wonderful moment where the Dennis Leary character and the Kevin Spacey character are talking about butterfly ballots and hanging chads. It's like a minute that explains this, and it works just beautifully.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that was one of my favorite scenes too, which could have been just really expositional, but those two guys found a way to turn it into something. They improvised a little bit. We didn't improvise much on that, but some of that was Dennis and Kevin just going off.
Right, and the visuals of actually illustrating what they're talking about, which I think is your craft at work, was terrific. Let's listen to some of that scene.
Right now, we're down by less than 2,000 votes. Meanwhile, there's 175,000 ballots out there that the count machines have declared non-votes, okay? So that's 175,000 uncounted ballots.
How does a thing like that even happen?
Because punch card ballots are okay, they're primitive. You got cardboard chads that get punched but don't go all the way through the hole, so they're hanging off the edge of the ballot.
Hanging chads.
Chad.
What?
There's no S.
The plural of Chad is Chad.
That's great democracy.
Jesus.
Yeah. So when you take these ballots and you put them through the tabulating system, what happens is the hanging chad get pushed back into the holes, and the machines read it as if the holes were never actually punched. So then these are discarded as undervotes. But wait, sometimes hanging chad don't even hang. They're just dimpled.
Dimpled?
Yes. Okay, which means that the voter didn't align the ballot properly in the machine or just didn't push hard enough to get the chad to go through to the other
side.
Well,
how hard is this to punch a paper ballot?
It's pretty hard when you're 80-something years old, you're arthritic, and you're blind as a bat. Unfortunately for us, blind bats tend to vote Democratic. Not to mention the fact that the Votomatics, sometimes these things don't get cleaned up for years and years and years, so they can get completely jammed up with chads.
Chad.
And the next...
Sorry.
Next thing you know, it's impossible for the voter to actually penetrate it at all. So you just end up with dimpled chad. This tends to happen in poorer neighborhoods where they don't have up-to-date, brand-new voting equipment. And I don't have to tell you who those people, generally speaking, vote for, okay? All I'm saying, Ron, is we have to have actual live human beings doing this recount.
Well,
that's
what about Chris and Daley? They don't want
to. You know, doing a film on politics is such a minefield, particularly with this many, you know, prominent and living characters.
Yeah.
And I know that and there was a lot of effort in the script to make it historically accurate. Much of the dialogue is verbatim from firsthand accounts. And many folks liked it, including James Baker, who was a key member of the Bush team. But Warren Christopher was unhappy.
Right.
Said that they'd invent that the film had invented a character and put his name on it. How do you deal with criticism like that?
Well, I'm glad you asked me about that actually, because I was always puzzled by that. I got to listen to a lot of the interviews Danny did, and
that's the writer.
A lot
right,
of yeah. Danny Strong did write the writer, and you know, and people have come up to me since. Confirming that Danny got it right. I mean, that there were a lot of what happened in those rooms, a lot of what the choice the Democrats made, you know, which were, in my opinion, I mean, I actually identified with Warren Christopher because I, like him, believed that an election should be run in a sort of statesmanlike way. And he was criticized for it at the time, and I suppose in the film to some extent for seeing it that way. But I wanted to ennoble that. And so I really rooted for him. But I still think we got that right, and I was disappointed that that came out that way, because I just think I think he was worried about how he was portrayed, but I wish he wasn't, and I think it was fairly portrayed.
Right. I mean, just to clarify for folks who may not have seen the film, and Warren Christopher was there to direct the gore effort, and his notion was this needs to be a statesmanlike effort. We're not going to sue. It's not a street fight. And the Bush team much more ready to mix it up and seeing this as a political brawl that they had to win. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with actor Steve Carell and director Jay Roach. Their latest film is Dinner for Schmucks. We have to talk about The Office, you know, the NBC series, which this is 7 seasons now, right? And it is the last. Is that right, Steve Carell?
Not the last for the series. The last for me, yeah. I want to honor my contract, and that was always my contract was always for 7 seasons. And I want to fulfill that, and then I thought it was time to move on. I'd like to spend some more time with my family. I have 2 little kids. And it just seemed like the time was right for me. But, you know, I've been asked this before. I think the show is incredibly strong and the writers are great. And the cast is really an ensemble. I've always thought of myself as a member of this great ensemble cast. So I see it as just one member of that ensemble sort of drifting off. And the show has shown itself to be very resilient and you know, to incorporate new characters and new scenarios and storylines. So I have no doubt that it'll continue to be incredibly strong.
Well, that'll be a challenge losing this member of the ensemble, I think. Why don't we listen to a clip from a recent episode? This is Steve Carell, our guest, playing Michael Scott, who has corralled the staff of the Dunder Mifflin Company for another meeting that nobody really wants to attend.
Who enjoys the weekends? Of course. Now, the weekend is always great if you have someone, which I do. I have Donna. She is hot. She has a Pilates butt. But we need to find something to do this weekend besides have sex. Did I say that? Yes, I did. And the reason you are here is that I need ideas for things that Donna and I can do on the weekend. So just shout it out.
I have an idea for your weekend.
Okay.
Let me go back to my desk right
okay.
now.
Okay, you get out of here, big dog. No. You guys sit down. I need ideas.
Stanley got to go.
Yeah, well, Stanley doesn't help with anything. Come on. Shout him out.
Walk around apple orchards.
Oh.
Super romantic.
That's fun. Eel fishing. All right.
Curl up with your favorite DVD.
You and Donna should hit the Poconos. They have heart-shaped jacuzzis. Room enough for free.
We actually went to the Poconos last Tuesday. We headed up there. We went to a little Chinese bistro. P.F. Chang's.
Why would you go all the way to the Poconos to P.F. Chang's when we have the Great Wall? It's granted.
Because when your super hot girlfriend says, I want to go to Mount Pocono, you go to Mount Pocono.
Still funny to me. Steve Carell in The Office with that ensemble cast. You really think that your role could be replaced, all modesty aside?
Yeah, I do. I don't even think it's a matter of replacing the role. I think it's a matter of just sort of shifting the dynamic of the show. And ultimately, I think it might not be a bad thing because, you know, I think shows can get complacent or audiences can become complacent about them. And even if a show stays consistent and very high in quality, people get used to it and then they want something else to happen. And I think this might be a good thing.
And you've been making a lot of films. I mean, you've been really, really active. Are you going to stay as active making films?
I would love to, yeah. I mean, that's the hope. But you never know. I don't take any of it for granted. I'm very fortunate to have had this level of success. So I guess I'm always waiting for the other shoe to drop. I'm always waiting for the career to go off the cliff. So I'm prepared. If it does, I'm fine with that, and I've had a good run. So, but yeah, I mean, I'd love to continue to work. It'd be nice.
Well, you'd said you wanted to spend more time with your family, and I
well, that's that, just that, that's yeah. just to engender goodwill and
that's what you say when you don't really sympathy. Want to explain why you're leaving
that's
the office.
Right. Yeah, it's real. I don't even remember my kids' names, frankly.
Steve Carell, Jay Roach, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Steve Carell and Jay Roach spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Carell stars in the new movie Dinner for Schmucks. Roach directed it. The film opens this Friday. You'll find links to clips from the film on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, our rock historian Ed Ward profiles one of the most unusual rhythm and blues singers of the early 1960s, Sugar Pie DeSanto. This is Fresh Air. The early 1960s was a great time for female rhythm and blues singers, with talents like Etta James, Betty Everett, Coco Taylor, and Irma Thomas, to name a few. One of the most unusual was an athletic young woman who stood 4 feet 11 inches and was half Filipina called Sugar Pie DeSanto. Rock historian Ed Ward has her story.
Keep my man satisfied.
Sugar Pie DeSanta was born in Brooklyn in October 1935 and was christened Umpalaya Marcema Ballantone. Her father was Filipino, her mother African-American. Her mother had been a concert pianist, but Sugar Pie says her father couldn't carry a tune in a bucket. He moved the family to San Francisco when Palaya, as they called her, was four, and soon enough, the young girl discovered dancing and singing and made a fast friend with a neighbor named James Zeta Hawkins, who was a member of a girl gang called the Lucky Twenties. James Zeta wound up in jail for her gang activities, and when she got out, she formed a singing group with one of Palaya's younger sisters. Palaya looked on in envy as James Zeta was discovered by bandleader Johnny Otis and rechristened Etta James. She started entering talent contests in San Francisco and won so often they told her to stop entering. At another talent contest in L.A., Otis saw her again and offered to record her. He made good on his offer and gave her a stage name, too, Little Miss Sugar Pie. She continued to record throughout the late 50s, often with her husband Pee Wee Kingsley, and they finally found success with a song called I Want to Know on an Oakland-based label, Check. Shortly thereafter, their marriage fell apart, and Sugar Pie went to Chicago, where Chess Records had offered her $10,000 to record for them. She signed in 1962, but didn't see any success until 1964.
Baby, my red dress in the cleaner, but my shift will steal the show. Baby, my red dress in the cleaner's child, but my shift will steal a show. Yes, it's fitting, child, it's fitting, and it ain't the back that's cut too low. Ain't wear my high heels.
Riding on the back of Tommy Tucker's high-heeled sneakers, Slip-In Mule told how sneakers hurt DeSanto's feet, but not to worry, she'd be the hit of the dance anyway. Then the hits kept coming. Use What You Got and another song about clothing.
I'm gonna put on my dress.
Soulful Dress is probably Sugar Pie's best-known song these days, not least because Texas songstress Marcia Ball has had it in her set for years. But it also established Sugar Pie's persona, an assertive young woman who took no mess. With this, and its successor I Don't Want to Fuss hitting the charts, Sugar Pie went off to tour Europe, and they're still talking about her shows, wild dancing and standing backflips included, and her using martial arts on a hefty guy who invaded the stage in England. Back in Chicago, she met Sheena DeMel, an unsuccessful songwriter who was the girlfriend of one of Chess's most successful ones, Billy Davis. In no time, the two women had written a strong song, too strong for one woman to sing, but just strong enough for two if the other was Etta James.
I don't want to believe the bad things about you. Oh, no, no. Cause if they're true, I have to get along.
That hit the top 10, so the duo did another one, which evoked the years when they ran with the Lucky Twenties. It didn't do as well, and Sugar Pie went back to writing some more with Sheena DeMel. Her next record was a result of that collaboration.
I've got to let go, go power. I'm gonna kick all my
Go-Go Power didn't chart and was Sugar Pie's last record for Chess. Sugar Pie kept on writing songs and recorded for a few more labels without much success and eventually moved back to the Bay Area, settling in Oakland. She's been married twice to Jim Moore, her current husband, who's 17 years younger than her. He also manages her as she continues to perform, not only in clubs in California, but in blues and jazz festivals all over the world. In September 2008, she was given a Pioneer Award by the Rhythm and Blues Foundation. When it was time for her to perform, she kicked off her shoes and did a backflip.
Ed Ward lives in the south of France. He reviewed Sugar Pie DeSanto, Go-Go Power, the complete Chess singles, 1961 to 66. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm gonna be a party popping, show stopping, wig flopping witch for her.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we add one more tribute to Daniel Shore, who continued to be an NPR news analyst until a few weeks before his death last week. We'll listen back to the interview we recorded in 1994 on the 20th anniversary of Nixon's resignation. We talked about Shore's CBS coverage of Watergate and his run-ins with CBS and the Nixon administration. Join us for the next Fresh Air.